Welcome to Indie Author Answers, a podcast about the craft of writing and being an indie in the world of self-publishing. Each week, we'll read a chapter from an unpublished novel and critique it. To read along with the show, go to indieauthoranswers.com. To follow along from chapter one, go to jimheskett.com/part1. Or to get a recap of the first half of the story, go to jimheskett.com/recap. Now, let's get this mother started. So here's your host, Jim Heskett.
Hey party people, welcome back to Indie Author Answers. We've missed you over the last 7 days and now we're here. And so welcome to the show. I'm excited to be here. I hope you're excited to be here. We're in the home stretch. There's only a few more episodes left to read this book. And next week, we are finally going to get to the chapter which reveals the big plot twist, which we've been building up to for a year and change. It's been a long time coming. Some of you probably already guessed it, but it's coming up next week. And today we're going to read a couple of short chapters, a Megan chapter and an Alex chapter. And the end is nigh. We're building up to the great big climax of the book. But before we get into that, let's do a little tip of the week. And this week I want to talk about what are the things that you as an indie author should spend money on. Last week I talked about reasons why you might not want to self-publish, and if you are broke and can't afford some of the upfront costs of self-publishing, that might be because there are some things you're going to have to put up money on. One of the things that clickbaity articles that are anti-IndiePub say that, oh, it's too so expensive because it's going to cost you $30,000 to acquire all the things you need to publish, and they're mostly talking about bullshit vanity presses and evil fuckers like that. But there is a little bit of upfront money you have to spend, and so these are the things that you're going to have to spend money on. You need to spend money on a good cover. Now, you can design one yourself, and that may have worked in 2011 or 2012 to have a crappy book cover. But now it's just no longer acceptable. Readers know the difference between a quality, professionally made cover and something that's crap, and they don't accept anything that's crap. So you can get a cover made for probably for a couple $100, you know, anywhere between. You could get a pre-made cover for under $100. I've done that before, even though most of the pre-made covers I've actually replaced with custom-made covers because I think they look better. You could get custom-made covers for $200-$300, maybe a little more. I know that 99 Designs is a popular company, and I think you pay like $300 to get a cover, and then you get lots of different designs to choose from. They don't sponsor the show or anything, but that's just one of the options that I hear a lot, particularly because they sponsor the self-publishing podcast, so they do an ad read for them every week. So that's number one, get a good cover. Number two, pay for editing. Now, this is probably the most painful one to pay for because it is an expenditure. And I can't, it's hard to quote a price range because it matters entirely on how long your book is, how clean it is when you give it to an editor, what kind of editor, you know, if you're just using a line-by-line editor. You can expect to pay at least a few $100s, and it's going to be a big chunk of change, and it's worth it, particularly if you're trying to produce content fast. Because, you know, maybe you could get away with using beta readers to help you do developmental edit stuff, and maybe you could get away with using an app like the Hemingway app or Grammarly. I've used both of those in the past to self-edit some of my own stuff, but usually I was self-editing them before I turned them over to an editor because I wanted to get as clean copy as possible to an editor. You can maybe get away with that, but these days, even a few typos in a book can ruin the experience. Even a few poor grammar spots in your book can ruin the experience for readers. So it's worth it in the long run to spend that money. Consider it, and don't consider it an expenditure. Consider it an investment in your future because you're ensuring a quality product. you're ensuring better reviews, or you're ensuring a lack of bad reviews, at least, I could say. And so it's absolutely worth it. So those are the main two things that you need to have before your book is published. The main thing that you need to spend money on after your book is published is promotion. So I'm not going to go into all the ins and outs, but I use a lot of services like Read Cheaply, Betty Book Freak, Kindle Nation Daily, those kinds of sites where you put your book on sale and then you pay to have these sites promote your book to their mailing list or on their website or on social media. And they are absolutely worth it. Some are better than others. I've used a couple dozen of them for different for various books, and I'm still experimenting trying to figure out which ones are the best. I mean, absolutely the best is BookBub, and I talked at length about when I got a BookBub for my book Wounded Animals last year in December 2015, and it was worth every penny that I spent on it. Absolutely. I paid like $270 to promote a free book, and it was absolutely worth it in terms of the mailing list signups that it got me and sell-through on the second and third books in the trilogy. I made my money back in like a day. So, yeah, that's absolutely worth it. And if you get a BookBub on a paid book, which I haven't done yet, but that's the next thing I'm going for is BookBub on a paid book. From everything that I hear is that that's worth it too. And there's several other ones that are good. So promotion, yeah, you absolutely need to pay for a promotion. What other things do you need to pay for? There's lots of little incidentals, like maybe you need to pay for a website design if you're not comfortable doing it yourself. Maybe you pay to have professional author photos done. That's something that I still haven't done yet. The author photo that I mostly use on the internet is a picture my wife took of me when we were in Australia in 2009. And I need to get professional author photos done, and that's something that's on my list. It's just not a high priority. You need to pay for stuff like here's a good example of an incidental you need to pay for. You have a mailing list. You need to put your physical address on that mailing list. That's non-negotiable. And so unless you're comfortable putting your home address at the bottom of every email you send out, you're going to need to get a mailbox or a P.O. box. And that's something you're going to have to pay for. I pay like $80 a year for mine. But for me, it's worth it because when I'm sending out an email to 1,000 people, I'm not going to put my home address on there. That's just cray. I'm not going to do it. So I pay $80 a year for a mailbox, and it's entirely worth it for me. There are other things other incidentals that I pay for, like I paid $40 for Scrivener, and it's absolutely worth it. There are a lot of things that you shouldn't pay for, so things like Author Solutions, everyone knows how evil those are. There are a lot of services that you might think you need, but you don't need. Here's something that I pay for. Every time that I publish a paperback copy through CreateSpace, I spend the $10 to get the custom ISBN. Because I want my imprint, my publishing company, which is actually a registered doing business as in the state of Colorado, is called Royal Arch Books. And I always want my publications to be associated with Royal Arch Books because I'm building a brand. So if you use the free CreateSpace assigned ISBN on your paperback books, it's going to say published by, and I think it says CreateSpace or something like that, but I don't want that. I want it to say published by Royal Arch Books. Maybe that seems insignificant or a small thing, but it's important to me. It's important to my brand. I want that to say published by Royal Arch Books. And for me, that's worth the $10 expenditure to get that done. And I think I probably rambled about that enough. I could talk on and on about the things that I spend my money on. I track all that stuff pretty diligently to keep my finances in order. But I won't go into it. I've already rambled too much. So let's get into our reading. And like I said, next week we're going to be getting to the Miguel chapter with the big plot twist. And today we're going to be reading part 4, chapter 19, and part 4, chapter 20. Chapter 19 is a Megan chapter, and if you remember the last time we saw Megan, she had been hiding out in a motel after she got into the altercation with Wiles. And she went out drinking with some friends, and she ended up getting pulled over and taken to jail. And the last time we saw Alex, he was talking with Wiles. He was all hopped up on the drugs, and they were getting ready to go, quote-unquote, take care of Brian and Miguel. As always, make sure you're going to www.indieauthoranswers.com to read along with the reading, and it'll make a lot more sense if you're reading along. Here we go, Chapter 19, Megan. Megan spent 2, maybe 3 hours handcuffed to a metal ring on a concrete bench at the police station. She did not know exactly because they had taken her phone and the holding room contained no clock. Enough time passed for her to sober up a few shades, and long enough for the concrete bench to make her butt so sore that every movement added a new dimension of ache. After the fingerprinting and paperwork, she had imagined they would throw her in some kind of drunk tank where she might sleep on a cot and have a metal toilet to use. But the reality was much less functional. Her room had 4 white walls, 2 doors with reinforced windows, and 2 white concrete benches. Occasionally a cop would come in one door, say nothing, and go out another door. She was just another part of the decor and not worth recognition. As time passed, Megan devised ways to keep herself busy. She imagined her therapist sitting on a bench across from her. "Megan," Dr. Foster would say, "how do you think you ended up here?" "I got drunk and I got pulled over. It's as simple as that." Is it that simple? Or is it possible that prior actions placed you in certain situations? "Are you saying it's my fault that Derek beat me up?" Megan would say. "Certainly not. No one deserves to be abused for any reason. But what I am saying is that you should take a look at your actions and think about how you ended up here." "I cheated on my husband." "That's a good start. Now, what else?" "I cheated on my last boyfriend before him. And I cheated on my first boyfriend in high school. I cheated on pretty much all of them, actually." "And?" "And why don't you just tell me, Dr. Foster? Obviously you have an opinion." In real life, Dr. Foster would never give her opinion outright. But this was Megan's fantasy, and she wanted the good doctor to lay it all out. "Your husband said you were untrustworthy. What was your response?" "You ran out and hopped into bed with Brian." "You perpetuated your cycle. You didn't like the way you felt, so you ran to a man to make it better. And in the process, you betrayed everyone around you, including yourself." Much about what she had thought true about herself turned out to be lies and justifications. Megan pulled on the cuffs, enjoying the tension from the unforgiving metal edges as they raked across her wrists. The pain was good, and she deserved it. A door opened, and along came an officer who removed the cuffs from her tender wrists and helped her stand. Her legs long since asleep, pins and needles attacked her at every step when she finally escaped the bench. She hoped to be able to sleep or to go home, but the cop, who turned out to be another mute, escorted her to a simple room with 2 chairs and a table and a mirror on the wall. He placed her in one of the chairs and then disappeared from the room without saying a word. Different surroundings, same situation. Megan smiled at her reflection in the mirror, then winked at whoever was on the other side. 30 more minutes passed in silence while Megan fixated on the hum of the room's forced air heating unit. Constant, repetitive sound, like a meditation. The door behind her opened and Megan expected another mute cop, but then instead found the familiar click of high heels on the floor. Megan turned towards the dark gray pantsuit and blonde ponytail of Walker as she strolled into the room. Megan laughed. "Oh, perfect," she said with as much sarcasm as she could manage. Walker, a manila envelope in her hands, sat down in the chair opposite Megan. "Hello, Megan," she said. "You've had quite a day, haven't you?" "I guess. I was wondering when you were going to show up. Nobody's talked to me in forever, and I've been here for hours. No one will tell me what's going on." "Things seem to have changed a little bit from the last time we saw each other," Walker said, nodding towards the makeup-covered bruise on Megan's face. "You know, I kept your card. I kept it in a lockbox under my bed. I would take that thing out once a week or so and just stare at it. I mean, really just stare at it. If I could add up all the minutes I spent staring at that damn thing. It's a shame that you didn't use it one of those times instead of just thinking about it. We wouldn't be where we are right now." "Oh yeah, where are we?" Walker laid the envelope on the table. Chapter 20, Alex. On the drive over to the apartment in Wiles' Jeep, Alex focused all of his energy on the task at hand. His fear evened out to a low, rumbling agitation, and he shifted his attention to inventing a justification for what he suspected would happen once they arrived at the apartment. Brian knew everything about Wiles, Alex, and the drugs, and if Brian had talked with the cops, he had to go. No other way around it. Kevin Werner was a problem, so he had to go. Brian is a problem, and he has to go. Drug dealers only get caught when they add someone that can't be trusted to the mix. Brian can't be trusted. They drove into the apartment complex and stopped at the gate. When Alex opened his mouth to tell Wiles the code, he realized that opening his clenched jaw felt like tearing a strip of rubber in two. He remembered he had some muscle relaxers in his bathroom. A Flexeril or two sounded like just the thing now to get him back to normal. They settled into a parking spot a few doors down from the apartment. Brian's car is gone, Alex said. I know, Mitch and them took it, those stupid crackheads. They sent it to get chopped, but they're going to bring it back tomorrow. Alex stared up the closed door to his apartment complex and reflected on the day they struggled to move the couch upstairs. Brian had deflected every idea Alex proposed of as Alex were just some novel inhabitant in Brian's world. Everything had to be his way. Alex withdrew the gun from his waistband, checked the weight of the clip, and clicked off the safety. The heft of the weapon now felt comfortable in his grip. Easy there, killer, Wiles said. We're not going to run in there guns blazing. We're in an apartment complex in Boulder. Look at all the cars around us in this lot and think about that for a second. What did you think was going to happen in there? Alex's finger rested on the trigger of a loaded gun, but he did not know why. Get angry, gun comes out. I guess I don't know. What is going to happen? Wiles sucked on his teeth and said, Well, I'd like to convince him to go for a drive with us. That would be the best outcome. But we're going to talk to him first because we need to make sure he knows how serious this is. Moment by moment, Alex alternated between uncertainty and resolve. Right now, resolve. I'm in. Fuck that controlling, self-righteous cocksmoker. I'll put the bullet in myself, Alex said, looking to Wiles for validation. Wiles glowered. You don't even pull that thing out unless I tell you to, okay? He said. Now that I think about it, you don't do shit unless I tell you to. Do what I say, and this is going to work out. We're the ones who determine how this goes. You understand me? Should we have brought backup with us? No, I keep telling you, we're just going to talk to him. Now put that gun back down in your pants before you shoot one of us in the damn face. Alex obliged as he and Wiles exited the car. Each step towards the apartment hitched Alex's heart rate another notch. By the time they reached that familiar white door, his hands were shaking and he fumbled the keys, almost dropping them. With a grunt, Wiles snatched the keys away from Alex. They entered and Alex flipped the light switch. The apartment was empty. He's not here, he said. I figured that out already. If he's not here, then where is he? Wiles plopped down on the couch and put his feet on the coffee table just as casual as could be. Alex thought about it. No car, nowhere to go. I'll bet he's at the construction site, Alex said. What do we do now? Why don't you get me a beer if you got one? Wiles said as he turned on the television. He flipped through some channels until he landed on the front gate feed. Excellent, he whispered to himself. Alex returned from the kitchen with a bottle. Should I go get him? What do we do now? Alex said. Now you calm the fuck down and we wait. All right. So we got a couple of chapters here. Some nice building tension, but some awkward prose for sure. Some clunky grammar and overwriting. Little too much telling instead of showing. And in the Megan chapter, there was one big plot hole. Well, not a big plot hole, but there was a plot hole, and I wondered if you spotted it while I was reading. I certainly did. It was something that stood out to me right away. I knew it even like right before I got there. I knew it was going to happen. Anyway, so let's go back and talk about some stuff. So the last time we saw Megan, she was getting arrested. And that was a nice left turn in the story. Because I don't know, because Megan's story is so kind of bland, I guess you would assume the whole time that once she has the contact with special agent or secret agent or whatever agent Walker, that eventually Megan is going to either, one, get killed by Wiles, or two, she's going to roll over on Wiles and talk to Walker. So the fact that she was so undecided about it and then she gets arrested sort of throws a nice curveball into that part of the story. You wouldn't expect it to happen. You wouldn't expect Megan to get pulled over for DUI. You wouldn't expect her to get arrested. But once she is arrested, it makes total sense that now she's being visited by Walker. That now that she's got this DUI hanging over her head, it's one of those things that a good plot twist is unexpected but inevitable. So now that we know that Walker is going to visit Megan, you're like, okay, this makes total sense. The story, it makes sense that the story would have veered into this direction because everything leads to a point. Because now Megan has a purpose in the story, whereas basically throughout the entire book up until this point, Megan hasn't had much of a purpose. She's provided exposition. She has, you know, her main purpose was that she slept with Brian, which I won't even get into how sexist that is, but she slept with Brian, so she caused complications between Brian, Alex, and Wiles. So that was her really her main purpose up until this point of the story. And now she's actually going to contribute to the plot based on things that she does, and I won't tell you exactly what happens after that. But so this is good, because you want all of your subplots to wrap up by the end of your book. If your subplots don't wrap up, don't intertwine, don't tie into the main plot, then they don't serve any purpose. So this Megan chapter was roughly 750 words, and most of it has nothing to do with anything. It's really only the last 150 words or so when Walker comes in that that this chapter means anything. So what we have here is Megan is sitting in jail. She's confused. She's just chained to a concrete bench. Her butt's sore. She doesn't know what's going on. And then we have this extended italicized fantasy sequence with her imagining a conversation with her therapist. Now, here's what I was attempting to do with this mini, with this fantasy sequence within the scene. I was attempting to give Megan an arc. I was attempting to reveal something about her. I was attempting to show that Megan has changed over the course of the story. Does it work? No, not really, because we haven't seen Megan change over the course of the story. She's basically just been this kind of bitchy person who is not relatable, not interesting. But what you're supposed to get here is that Megan comes to this realization that she's a cheater, and she's always been a cheater, and the fact that she's a cheater is why she's in the situation she's in right now. I don't really think it works. I don't know if a fantasy sequence, if an imagined conversation with her therapist is the best way to demonstrate that. I mean, it is technically showing. It would have been telling if it would have just been Megan suddenly realized that she had cheated on everyone she'd ever known. Another common way that you might show this instead of tell it would be for her to be looking at old photographs or something, and she lines them up and says, you know, I cheated on this guy, that guy, that guy. That would have been a little better showing than her just coming to the realization. But this conversation with Dr. Foster is supposed to get that point across. And so the end result of it is this line in here, like where Megan pulled on the cuffs, enjoying the tension from the unforgiving metal edges. The pain was good and she deserved it. So ultimately, Megan comes to this realization about herself, and it's not freeing, it's damning. Because in this book, you'll see that certain characters' arcs or their intended arcs are tragic, and certain ones are heroic. Where basically, they're all tragic, but there's hope to some of them. Megan very much has a tragic arc. Because if you look back to the beginning of the book, she has everything in a way. She's got the hot boyfriend, she's in college, she's young and beautiful. And now by the end of it, she's here in jail, handcuffed to a bench, and she's realizing that she has caused all of her own misery because she's been unfaithful to every guy she's ever been with. And moral judgments aside, it is a tragic story for Megan, and it's not something I don't enjoy reading it. I don't think a reader would enjoy reading it. I mean, you can have tragic arcs and stories and write them well. Megan certainly isn't, and I don't think I have to explain why Megan's tragic arc isn't enjoyable to read, because she's not enjoyable. Hint, hint. Someone with a tragic arc who is enjoyable, Walter White in Breaking Bad, and I won't spoil anything, although I think I'm pretty sure I probably spoiled Breaking Bad multiple times on this podcast before, but Walter White is a very tragic, tragic arc, but it's fascinating to watch, and so if you haven't seen that show, I highly recommend it. So then the cop, they escort her to a different room with a two-way mirror. And now here is where the plot twist is. Did you see it? Did you see it coming? All right, I'm about to tell you. Not plot twist, the plot hole. So she looks at the mirror, she winks at the, or she smiles at the reflection of the mirror and then winks at it. Then a door opens behind her, and she has to turn her head around to see who it is. Well, duh, there's a mirror right in front of her. Why would she have to turn around to see who was at the door? Right? That's a plot hole. That's something that I should have spotted, or a beta reader or an editor should have spotted. She doesn't need to turn around. She just looks up and she sees Walker standing behind her in the mirror. And then she spins around as if to confirm it. Now, Walker sits down and they have a very brief conversation that I think that in my newer fiction, the fiction I've written in the last couple of years, I've gotten much, much better at writing dialogue. And I think for the most part, the dialogue in this book in The Problematic Virtue is poor. But I think that this conversation between Megan and Walker is some of the best dialogue in this book. A lot of it actually works, and there's some... So one of the things about good dialogue, when in real life, when people are talking back and forth, it's not always question-answer. Someone might ask a question, and then the other person might not answer it. Someone might make a statement, and then the next person doesn't exactly respond. They might change the topic. It's hard to do that in fiction. It's hard to get that that kind of that rhythm, that nuance, that that flow of real conversation and dialogue. And you don't want it to be exactly real. You know, you don't want ums and ahs and stuff that's going to be confusing. But you want it to emulate normal human speech as closely as possible. And so I think this conversation here between Megan and Walker actually works. When Walker says things like, "You've had quite a day, haven't you?" And Megan responds by saying, "I was wondering when you were going to show up." And then Walker says, "Things seem to have changed a little bit since the last time we saw each other." And Walker nods toward the makeup-covered bruise on Megan's face. That's a good bit. That sounds like realistic dialogue. What would have been unrealistic would have been for Walker to say, "Things seem to have changed a little bit since the last time we saw each other. You have a black eye." That would have been on-the-nose dialogue, and it's much better combining the dialogue and the action, because Walker says something, then she nods at the makeup-covered bruise, and now because of that action beat after the dialogue, we know what Walker actually meant in her dialogue. And then we get the continued tragedy of Megan's story, because she says that she thought about calling Walker many times, and she just couldn't get around to doing it. She looked at the card, and now Walker's like, "Oh, you should have done it. Now we wouldn't, because then we wouldn't be where we are." And where are we? Walker lays an envelope down on the table. This is a great cliffhanger, because we think we know what's in the envelope, because we know that Walker was interested in Wiles' criminal activities and the first time they talked, but we don't know for sure. It could be anything in that envelope. And we're going to have to wait a couple chapters to find out what is in the envelope. And then we transition to part 4, chapter 20, Alex. In this Alex chapter, not a whole lot happens, but compared to the last Alex chapter, I think we read it last week, or maybe it was the week before, where Wiles got off the phone with Miguel, and Alex was all high on meth, and he tripped on the porch, and the gun went skittering, and then he went and loaded the gun, and he was all freaked out and trying to convince himself. Whereas in that chapter, there was so much overwriting and poor attention and too much foreshadowing. That was basically the theme of that. In this chapter, Alex's interior monologue, while it's not great, it's much better. It's not overblown. It's not too on the nose and obvious. It's much more effective here. Because what we see, we spend almost this entire chapter in Alex's head in relatively close POV, you know, relatively close for this book. And we get some good interior monologue where he's saying Kevin Werner was a problem, he had to go. Brian's a problem, he has to go. Brian can't be trusted, and drug dealers only get caught when they have someone who can't get trusted. So we see Alex trying to justify it to himself, and this is pretty good showing. even though there is a line of telling right before that, he shifted his attention to inventing a justification for what he suspected would happen once they arrived in the apartment. That line there is totally unnecessary because it's like you tell the reader what they should think on that line, and then in the next paragraph you're showing the reader. So just take out the telling, leave the showing, and if you're showing well, you don't need the telling as well. And especially you don't need to tell audiences something twice. Respect their intelligence, let them figure it out. So also here in the last chapter, Alex was really wishy-washy about what was going to happen. Would he be able to shoot somebody if he had to? But now we're seeing a more resolved Alex. Alex, and this is more or less by design. We want to see Alex wavering back and forth because we don't want to give the reader too clear a picture of what's going to happen. We want to foreshadow a little bit, but not make it too clear, because Alex is looking up at their apartment. He's thinking about the couch that they had moved up, and he's realizing that Brian was always been controlling, or at least this is Alex's point of view on what happened that day when they were trying to move the couch up on the day they moved in together. And he realizes, you know, he says Alex was just some novel inhabitant in Brian's world. So he takes the gun out, and he thinks they're getting ready to run up there, and he's just going to shoot Brian. He's high enough, he's brainwashed enough into Wiles' theology that he's just going to shoot Brian. And Wiles is like, easy, you know, we're not going to do it that way. And Alex is confused, and this is good. This is good that Alex is confused. He doesn't know what to happen, because Alex's confusion makes the reader believe that Alex is unpredictable, and that's exactly what we want. We want the reader to think they know what Alex is going to do next, but then when he's behaving erratically and confused, then we really don't know what he's going to do next. And another thing that's interesting here is that if you think that they were going over to kill Brian, they would have brought a bunch of people with them, and it's good that I addressed this in the text, where Wiles is saying, we're just going to talk to him, and Alex is saying, should we have brought backup with us? This is the kind of thing that would have closed. I probably came from beta reader feedback, where they said, well, if they were there to kill him, why, you know, they're not going to walk into an apartment complex where there's all these people around and shoot him, and why wouldn't they go in there with like 12 guys and gun Brian down? Why is it just the two of them? So the plan is they're not going to kill Brian. They're going to take him. They're going to convince him to go on a drive. And then there's two other things here that I want to mention. So Alex figures out when they enter the apartment and it's empty, Wiles sits down, and there probably should be more here about why Alex doesn't understand how Wiles is so casual. There's just a small mention about it where he says, like, Wiles is just as casual as could be. There maybe should be a little bit more about that, because Alex is freaking out, so he's probably confused about why Wiles isn't freaking out, how Wiles can... Like, he could look up to Wiles and say, I wish I was as casual as he is about this whole thing, and that would lend credence to the idea that Alex is fully bought into Wiles' theology and that Wiles is his mentor. Or he could be maybe angry at Wiles for thinking this is so casual. Maybe he could feel shame because he's not as relaxed as Wiles. He could feel shame because he's freaking out and his mentor is so cool. There are a lot of different ways that I could have taken that, but it's basically just glossed over. So they know that Brian's at the construction site, and I'm pretty sure next week we're going to see Brian at the construction site because, you know, of course, Brian's going to come back and they're all three going to be in the apartment together for the big showdown. And the other thing is the front gate feed. Now, I mentioned this. It's only appeared in the text, I think, twice before this. Once, that they have a camera on their front gate, and so you can see who's driving up. Now, it's probably been a long time in the text since it's been mentioned, so it should be explained a little better here. But I remember when I mentioned it way back then, it appeared at the beginning of part 3 when they first had this party. I mentioned that it was going to be important in the climax of this book. So it is coming up, and so it's mentioned here. Wiles turns on the TV, and he stops flipping channels when he lands on the camera feed that shows the front gate. Now, you could probably guess how this is going to come into play in the story, but I'll just say, leave you with this decision. Is this foreshadowed enough? Or, that's not what I meant to say. Scratch that. Is this explained enough? Do you remember enough about the front gate feed when it's been mentioned a couple times before that just having the words "the front gate feed" here, does it help you explain and remember the importance of it to the story? The fact that it's been mentioned three times in the story so far would lend credence to the idea that it's important, but has it been too long since it's been mentioned for you to get what it's saying? I'll leave you with that. 7 more days for you guys to think about it, and 7 more days for you to wait till we read the chapter with the big plot twist next week. I'm excited to get there because I've been kind of dancing around it, hinting at it, and not wanting to spoil it for so long. I'm stoked, and I'll see you guys in 7 days. All right, bye.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I know, but don't be sad. We will be back. Please, don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher or wherever else you happen to have found it. I mean, wherever it was, they're obviously got good taste, so please rate and review it anyway. Also, we'd like you to check out our blog at indieauthoranswers.com. You can also, I mean, if you're up for it and you've got time, pop on over to jimheskett.com, and you can even sign up for the email list and you'll get free stuff. I mean, who doesn't like free stuff, right? Of course you do. So go on, you can do that as well. By the way, don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter at IndieAnswers, and you can like our Facebook page. And if you've still got time for that, then obviously you haven't got much time left for writing. And let's face it, that's what this is about in the end. So once you've done all that, why not go out there and write something? I mean, it's what Jim wants you to do. And if Jim wants you to do it, then you should really do it. Thank you.